Thank you for all the team, Lord Hola and Julius Schedule. Thank you both so much for making this possible. As many of you probably already know, Ajahn Brahm was born Peter Beck in London in 1951. Coming from a working class background, he went on to study theoretical physics at Cambridge University. And after graduating from Cambridge, he taught in high school for a year before traveling to Thailand to become a monk and train with the Venerable Ajahn Chah at Bodhinaya Mahathera. While still in his years as a junior monk, he was asked to undertake the compilation of an English language guide to the Buddhist monastic code, the Vinaya, which later became the basis for monastic discipline in many Theravada monasteries in Western countries. Currently, Ajahn Brahm is the abbot of Bodhinaya Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia, and the spiritual director of an impressive number of Buddhist societies. In October 2004, he was awarded the John Curtin Medal for his vision, leadership, and service to the Australian community by Curtin University. Ajahn Brahm has also written, I believe, 3 books.
Seven or eight.
Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry for being ill informed. I hear from a pile of them right now. A number of his books will actually be on sale after this event around the entrance to the chapel, and if you would like to have your book signed by Venerable Ajahn Brahm, you can do so. He has been very influential in establishing the Dhammasala Nuns Monastery in the hills northeast of Perth to be a wholly independent monastery for nuns. In October 2009, he was instrumental in facilitating the Bhikkhuni ordination at this monastery. The selfless action of providing an authentic pathway for women to lead a holy life led to a reaction from fundamentalist monks within his original training sangha who excommunicated him. Large parts of the international Buddhist community have since rallied and campaigned in support of him, and it is this really groundbreaking movement, Ajahn Brahm's part, has made many people in the world aware of him and grateful to him or provoked by him. And so, with that exciting introduction, I turn the floor over to you.
Thank you. So the topic this evening is about gender equality in Theravada Buddhism, and whatever we do in Theravada Buddhism will affect the other Buddhisms as well. But the story behind this, Adi, you received a very good education, trained in the West, where you're always encouraged to question. And no lecturer which I ever went to, I would ever stop you from questioning anything they said. In fact, I was encouraged. I encouraged to see things in a different way, to question in a different way. And that was such a powerful part of my training in university. Well, I took that into my monastic life. And unlike other monks in traditional Asian country, my upbringing was counter to the idea in Asia and the Confucian values, always to respect your elders and teachers to the point where you never question what they say. Whenever any elder says something, it must be right simply because they are senior. And that was a tradition for many years for me. You know, I went to the northeast of Thailand in 1974, where I spent 9 years there. It was a very good grounding for me in a traditional Buddhist country. That part of Thailand had never been touched by the West. In Burma, Sri Lanka, that had been colonized. Even in Bangkok, it wasn't formally colonized, but it was under the control of the American government in Bangkok. They were fighting a war, you know, with the Vietnamese and the Laos and the Cambodians. But there were many places I went to as a monk in the northeast of Thailand, where I was the first white man they'd ever seen, let alone a monk. And so it was a very fascinating experience for me to see an indigenous Buddhist culture. and being a monk, I was accepted, you know, into their society. I had a position already, and so they treated me, because I was a monk, just as they would have treated a Thai monk. So I had this wonderful experience of seeing a culture from the inside, where everything was open to me. And there were many, many things which I saw about how the devotion to your teacher, that people would literally give their lives for their teacher, let alone sort of just following them. They would never ever question. But being a Westerner and having a good education, one of the things I did notice that the Caucasian monks who joined that tradition, people interested in Buddhism and having wanted an authentic teacher, we did question, we did want to learn. And in Theravada Buddhism, you know, we have what we call the sutras. It's just like the scriptures of Buddhism, which are supposed to go back to the Buddha himself. We have the monastic discipline, Vinaya, which is also supposed to go back to the teacher himself. But those books, which were available, I learned how to read Thai. Those books were kept in a cabinet in the main hall, which was locked, and all we ever did was bow to them, but never read them. And that was actually a great symbol for what that early type of Buddhism was. The teachings were revered, but never actually opened up and looked at. But of course, being a Westerner, you know, we managed to get some of those sutras, you know, from overseas, and to read them. And for me and many other monks, it was an eye-opener to actually to see and read what the Buddha actually taught, how he behaved, and what the rules were for the monastics. And because, you know, we looked at that source rather than just following the teacher and the teacher's teacher, we managed actually to go back to the source. And of course, you recognize there's many things done in traditional Buddhist countries which were totally against what the Buddha advised. So many of you may have noticed in many Buddhist temples, especially the cultural temples, there's so many rituals. And when I was talking with the professor of physics at the University of Western Australia, because I was a physicist, I kept up my contacts. And when I went to do a talk with him once, I asked him if he was interested in Buddhism. He said he was once, as a young man, and he went to Thailand to try and study or at least explore Buddhist teachings. But whenever he went to any Buddhist temple in Bangkok or outside, all he ever heard how to do was how to bow, how to light incense, how not to put your feet at the Buddha. He never actually learned what the Buddha actually taught or what his Buddhism was all about. And it was then that I just mentioned that often in many Buddhist temples you cannot see the Buddha for the incense smoke. The cloud of incense obscures the Buddha. And that's a metaphor for all the traditions are so thick you can't understand what the teaching of Buddhism really are. But of course, being a Westerner, you looked at that. And one of the things which I discovered in Buddhism, which is all Buddhism from all traditions, is that the way that the Buddha set up, you know, the community of monks and nuns, was as a very pure democratic system. Sometimes people say that democracy started in Greece, and there is no ground for that, because these are ancient texts, authentic, which we call long-standing democracies of many centuries, you know, around India. They had little states in India which were democratic. And it was very similar to the democracies in Greece, where there wasn't a franchise for everybody, and there wasn't a franchise for women. It was just the wealthy men, the landowners, the aristocracy, the elite, could actually go to meet together regularly in a place called the Sabha, which is now the name of the Indian Parliament, currently. They meet together and discuss matters democratically. And that was the model the Buddha used. And with democracy also came autonomy. So when the Buddha set up the management, the governance of his monastic communities, he made it so that every monastery, every community is totally independent. And every member of that community has an equal vote. It doesn't matter how enlightened you are or how many years you've been a monk or a nun. It is one vote for every monk or nun, no matter who you are. And that is the pure form of monastic governance which we do use even today, especially in monasteries like my own. Now it's important for you to know that governance, because what it does mean is that never was in the very beginning hierarchies. When the Buddha was about to pass away, this is common knowledge for anyone who's read the original teachings of the Buddha. Just before he passed away, he was asked, who will take over as leader once you pass away? And famously the Buddha said, no one will take over. There will be no head, no pope, no big shot leading Buddhism. He said, just let the teachings and the rules of governance be your teacher from here on. I've set it up and I don't want to have any leaders. Unfortunately, ever since that time, the systems of governance have changed within Buddhism. So we do have leaders, we do have abbots, we do have popes, we do have chief priests. And there are some Sri Lankans here. And in Sri Lankan Buddhism you have what's called Mahanayakas, chief priests. And I will tell you where that came from. That was instituted in the 19th century in Sri Lanka by the British, my ancestors, as a way to get control over the monks in that country who were very powerful. So what the British actually did, they chose monks who were compliant, senior enough, gave them this position of chief priest, a big fan and a little salary. Basically, they were literally in the pocket of the British rulers. And that is how they governed and took control of this independent and powerful unit of monks. It was typical British sneakiness. And of course, monks were given this family position, they felt very proud, and of course they coveted that, and so they would comply. Otherwise the Brits would take away their positions. But that is here today. I'm sure that here in Montreal, is there a Sri Lankan temple here in Montreal? Is there a chief priest, a Mahanayaka in Canada? There is. Yeah, there is one. And I don't know why they're still doing that. That was British shenanigans. But there never is a chief priest. So understanding that, when it came later on, I moved to Australia after 9 years in Thailand, and we started the hard work of establishing a monastery where, as a monk, you have to build it yourself at the same time as teaching, the same time as inspiring people and also affirming your own practice. It was really hard work. But of course, after developing your own monastery, then the question obviously came up for someone who was born and brought up in the West, where are the women monks? Many people asked that. And because you'd read the early sutras, you saw that this was always an inherent part of Buddhism. So much so that there is a story in the sutras that just after the Buddha became enlightened under the Bodhi tree, that he was approached by this fellow called Mara. Now you may take this to be a real person or just a metaphor for what the Buddha was thinking at the time. But suggesting to the newly enlightened Buddha, don't teach anybody else. Now one person's mind is enough in the world, and it's too much problem for you. Now you invite him, congratulations, don't teach, keep quiet, enjoy yourself, and pass away. And the response to that from the Buddha, and this was only a few days after his enlightenment, said, no, I will not pass away until I have established a strong monastic community of monks, a strong monastic community of nuns, women, a strong community of laymen, a strong community of laywomen. That was his mission after enlightenment. Very clear, repeated in all the different types of sutras and the different traditions. And according to the history of Buddhism, he lived another 45 years. You don't have to worry whether it was 45, less or more. But then was asked again by this man, said, look, you've done your job now. There's many, many nuns, enlightened, inspiring, huge communities of them. Many monks, huge communities, enlightened, great teachers. There's many, many thousands of laymen and laywomen who are Buddhists. You've done your job. And the Buddha said, yes, I have. So he said, okay, I'm going on 3 months. I say this because this was a mission of the Buddha from the very beginning. Now, over the centuries, the bhikkhunis died out, it seemed, especially in Theravada. And it's part of the democracy, the rules. You need another monk to create a monk. You need actually 5 monks to create another monk. You need another 5 nuns to create a nun. So, if there's no nuns left, how can you create a nun? And as a young monk, that's what I was always told. We can't revive the bhikkhunis, which is a word for nuns. We cannot revive the bhikkhunis because there's no bhikkhunis left. And I believed that for so many years. Until as I studied more, you know, in the Vinaya, this is the legal code of Buddhism, and started being in the West to meet monks and nuns of other traditions. Not just the monks who I knew from this little sect in Thailand called the Thai Forest Tradition. Meet other monks from Thailand who are fine. Meet Mahayana monks. Vajrayana monks, who you really got on with and found you had hardly any difference with. And you realize that these were monks just like you. And this is an important part to understand, that there is basically no difference in Buddhism between any sect at all. Mahayana, Vajrayana, Zen, Tibetan Buddhism, Thai Buddhism, Sri Lankan Buddhism. If you're a monk, you're a monk. You're a monk who follows Mahayana. You're a monk who follows Vietnamese tradition. You're a monk who follows Vajrayana. But first and foremost, you are a monk according to the legal system of Buddhism. All these sects come secondary. And the quote is about sects. Pali's Nana Samwasa, different communions. He said there's only 2 ways to make different communities. Either you are formally expelled out of one community, so you're different. And that's a very difficult thing to do. When you said I was excommunicated, that's what they did, but they didn't do it properly. So they don't know what they're doing. But either you send someone to a different community or you choose yourself to join a different community. And that's all it is. You can choose to join the same community again if you want to. That's all it is. So basically, a monk from any tradition, as long as they have been properly ordained, can fill a quorum for ordaining another monk. And the same with nuns. You don't have to have Theravada nuns to create a Mahayana nun.
any nun will do. And seeing that opened up the legal doors for the revival of the Bhikkhuni Sangha in Theravada, because the Chinese had maintained the lineage of Buddhist nuns from the time of the Buddha to today. There was a record of Sri Lanka sending bhikkhunis to China to actually to start off the lineage in China in the 13th century. And their lineage is still going. They don't look Sri Lankan, they don't wear the same robes, but that's their origin. So the nuns who call themselves bhikkhunis in China, Taiwan, Korea, are legitimate daughters, bhikkhunis, nuns of the Buddha, and they can form the quorum to create another bhikkhuni. And that's what we use to revive the Bhikkhuni Sangha. They ordained first of all with Mahayana bhikkhunis, and then they wore Theravada robes. That is totally legitimate. Those Theravada bhikkhunis, if they want to, they can change the robes. And they can go to a Vajrayana monastery and become Vajrayana bhikkhunis if they wish. You're a bhikkhuni, bhikkhuni first, and you can do whatever you like then. Join whatever sect of Buddhism, whatever flavour of meditation or dharma you prefer. And then you can move back and forth. And monks have done that before. Nuns can do that as well. So that meant we had a legal opportunity to revive, and we did. Now this, I wasn't the first to do this, to realize this. The first actually was the Theravada bhikkhunis was in Sri Lanka and Taiwan, Thailand. But of course, when I took over as the senior monk in a monastery in Western Australia, now I did attract many disciples, and from the beginning I realized that you do need, you know, not just need, but just why the hell not, to have equity in Buddhism. As a Westerner, you felt it wasn't complete until you had nuns with the equal opportunity as the monks. It never felt right to me because of my upbringing. Maybe if you're born in Sri Lanka or Thailand, maybe that you don't feel that way. Maybe if you were born in those Asian countries and you come and stayed in the West for all the time, you too realize that this is not fair. It's not just. It's not compassionate. It's not Buddhist. So of course the first thing which we did in Perth is you can't just obey someone and just leave them out in the cold. Was to get a monastery for them. So we bought a small piece of land in Perth, 583 acres. Because look, I respect the women of the bhikkhunis. I'm not going to just put them in just an old house somewhere. That is misogynistic. I want to do it well, respect the other gender. And then, once we had the land, then we got some women to go and live there. Once they established the place and they established respect from our local community, it was them who asked me, four of them, I think it's about time we became fully ordained as bhikkhunis. So personally, I wasn't on some crusade or mission. I wasn't going to change the Buddhist world. I'm not a hero. I was just responding to a legitimate request and saying, why not? Let's do it. So we did it. In the, what day is it today? What date of the month? 20th, okay. It's a shame this was not in 2 days' time. It was on the 22nd of October, 2009, we did the ordination. In 2 days' time, we had the 5th anniversary. It would have been amazing if it was 22nd today. That would have been weird.
Another 22nd,
21st, close. So the 22nd we did the ordination. Now remember, this is a decision of the local community. It has nothing to do legally with anybody else. Which is why It was just out of courtesy, not out of necessity, that I informed a couple of the other monks when I was visiting England. Basically, it had nothing to do with what we did in our monastery. And so we did the ordination. They tried desperately to stop it. But legally, they had no grounds. And Australia was a bit too far away for them to come and try and stop it. So geography, timing, everything was in our favor. And we ordained the four nuns. Legally, legitimately. Now, of course, that really upset some of the very conservative monks in the northeast of Thailand. The northeast of Thailand is like a Bible belt in Thailand of Buddhism. Very strong, faithful Buddhists, but also to know that that particular community where I think most of the senior monks have only had 4 years of education. They are not well trained, no intellectually. They have not read the sutras. They take the monastic discipline from what they've heard from their teachers, and much of it they haven't really understood. I'm saying that with respect, they're very nice people, but when it comes down to the legal position, they haven't got a clue. So they haven't got a leg to stand on there. And the ordination went forward, and I was summoned to Thailand, and basically, and this is a wonderful time in my life which I will never forget, and I'm very thankful I made the right decision. Many times you will have a situation where you have a choice between the easy way and the hard way which preserves your integrity. In the end, after a long meeting of 3 hours in the home monastery in Thailand, in Wat Pa Phong, with about 200 monks asking for my blood, they said, "Bob Monkso, if here and now, that you tell us, and you have to write this down afterwards, that these four women aren't bhikkhus, then everything will be forgiven. But if you insist that this ordination is legitimate, and these women have the right to be called bhikkhus, then you can never come back here." Now, these were my friends, people I've grown up with. And for so many years, the temptation was to take the easy way. But you just can't do that. So I said, "Okay, I'm out of here. These are the goodness." I'm very proud of that. I stuck to my integrity. And so I'm going to die a happy monk. If I had said no, I could never live with myself. I think I probably may have disrobed if I had said no. This, you made a huge mistake. And I can't live with that. So, and whenever that happens, you have a choice. Please always keep your integrity, no matter what cost it is. So I did that. And then afterwards, excommunication. And worse than that, what really surprised me was vindictiveness. They were trying actually to destroy me, saying the monastery where I lived had been given to that community and I had to give it back. I was asked to give a fat check, the worth of the monastery, to this temple. I was told that in a press conference, which was reported to the media and all the major newspapers in Thailand, that I had changed the constitution to meet my own ends, and basically had financial problems, the community, especially Thais, wanted the monastery back. All absolute untruths. Published in the newspaper and circulated by this head monastery. And I realized that whenever you have an institution like that, it does become very similar to a cult. And I remember reading books of people who had left cults. When you leave a cult for any reason, the next thing that happens to you is cult members try and destroy your reputation. And calling you all sorts of doing illegal things, bad things, whatever. And that was what really, really upset me. The people I respected would actually resort to such low tactics. It should have been just the live and let. If you don't agree with it, fine. But don't try and destroy things. But anyway, I had the strength at the time because I was already popular enough to withstand it. And of course it really helps when you do get support, and you get petitions supporting and people saying well done. Because sometimes you can make mistakes, and you need... Now, always the time I kept on thinking, have I done the right thing? Did I do the right thing? Because sometimes you do doubt yourself. But when you have support of many others, you realize, oh, this is a great thing to do. And so since that time, we've had a wonderful thing. I'm very glad I'm out of a great institution, you know, which was controlling you. It gave you the freedom which people had at the time of the Buddha to develop in the way which you feel the best, rather than being told by people above and beyond. There's no way that a person in Thailand can understand what's happening in Australia. There's no way in the old days that, you know, you were part of UK. There's no way that people in Westminster can understand Canada. You have to have autonomy. You have to devolve. Otherwise, the governance is just unresponsive. So when we went back to the way the Buddha originally taught, autonomous monasteries, every monastery could be responsive to its local community, to its local culture. And that's the way it was meant to be from the very start. So we were just being responsive to the local culture in the West, you know, giving equity, you know, to everybody. So when we gave equity to the women, it was a challenge to those people who didn't give equity. And of course that's one of the reasons why you get upset. When one person does the right thing, no one else can hide. And so that continues on even to this day. You know, that people criticize you. But what has actually happened now is the momentum of equity in Buddhism has got so strong. When I see somebody doing it, then everyone else has to follow it. Sooner or later. In Thailand, there are now about 500 bhikkhus. In Sri Lanka, about the same. So they're there, and they're growing. And now my job is actually to use my reputation. I have got, you know, a lot of support. YouTube is great, many people know me. Which means that I have the opportunity and the power to say, here are the bhikkhus, support them please. Because many traditional Buddhists, lay Buddhists, we give a lot of donations to monks and monasteries. And some monasteries you go to, Thailand, Sri Lanka, probably even here in Ottawa, are really nice. They're really comfortable. Sometimes they're over the top. But you go to a nun's monastery and it's nowhere near that. So my job now is not just to ordain, to train, to give support in those early years, and also to make sure they have enough to live and survive. And so they're in a situation which is equivalent to any monk's monastery. It's not just ordination, it's what comes afterwards as well. And now also you have the knock-on effect. His Holiness the Karmapa, you know, the leader of one of the great four Tibetan traditions, also wants to do ordination of women. And it's so easy to do now. So little by little there's a bad wagon coming. And my saying is, if you don't jump on the bad wagon, you'll get crushed under his wheels. That's the only choice you have. It also makes me and many others, you know, who like the Theravada teachings, or like Buddhist teachings, at last they don't feel embarrassed about saying we're a Buddhist. They see the equity to women as much as we have. And it's the same with gays. I've really stood up to the gay and lesbian community. Because again, I couldn't really have integrity as a Buddhist if any section of the community is discriminated against. And even recently, in Singapore, I gave a talk in which a question was asked, what do Buddhists think of gays and lesbians? I said exactly the same as I think of any other person. No discrimination at all. And it was put on a blog, on a webpage, And the Buddhist society who sponsored that talk took it off. And they said that was unacceptable because they were afraid. But before it was taken off, a minister in the Singapore government praised it. So it was put on again. Fear is what these leaders don't have the spine, the guts to stand up for what's right. Basically, Buddhism accepts gays, lesbians, totally. I've already done my first gay and lesbian marriage blessing. I've already done it. I'm proud of that. And why not? We have a Buddhist nuns module which is growing. If you haven't got the opportunity to come to Perth, have a look at it on the website. There's probably not equity anymore, they're probably better off than the monks are now. Why not? But up to the same standard. And the next thing I want is to get, not me coming here, but get nuns coming here, giving talks, leading meditation retreats. It's happening. Because it doesn't matter what gender you are when it gets to being a teacher. There have been, there will be many amazing women who teach. You judge a person not from their gender, not from their sexual orientation, not from their age, but for how they teach. Not whether they're Theravada, Mahayana, Vajrayana. People these days don't give a damn what tradition you're in as long as you give a good talk and it makes sense and it's inspiring. That's how it was, that's how it will be, that's how it should be. Now one thing which Devi wanted me to ask about was sometimes in the months at the back we'll ask about this. There are some very fundamental rules for the bhikkhuni. It's called the eight gaudamas. And things like the nuns, even a nun who's ordained for 50, 80 years should never pay respect to a monk, even if just born that day. Does that make any sense to you? Or, like many of you say, that's offensive. And I counter that, that it doesn't really make any sense, because one of the other beautiful stories, which is the Buddhism which inspired me and the Buddhism I want to practice, was of one of the Buddha's chief disciples, Sariputta, who was walking on arms around one day, and he was admonished, scolded by a little novice monk, who said, "Venerable sir, your robe is not in the right place, it's badly dressed." And he was scolded by someone much junior to him, and he was this big short monk. And this was the example which I would always take. So he put to look to see if he was right. He was right, he was badly dressed. So he went behind a bush, adjusted his robe, came out, and then he worshipped the little novice and called him teacher. Now that is Buddhism. If a nun admonishes me, I look and say, "Oh my goodness, you're right. Thank you, sister, teacher." Isn't that beautiful? It doesn't matter who you are, what gender you are, how senior you are. If you give me a good teaching, I respect that. Because we respect the teaching more than anything else. Now that sort of stuff, you know, is what inspires people. But the old ideas just can't sustain itself in our modern world. Sometimes there was an old saying, and this cannot be legitimate. Sometimes, when you have a look at these old sutras, you have to choose actually what is certainly the Buddha's words and what has crept in afterwards. And there's ways of finding that out. And one of the things which people quote was somebody saying, the Buddha saying, "If I obey the bhikkhunis, Buddhism will only last 500 years. That's obviously wrong because it's totally inconsistent. But I've used that saying to say if we don't have bhikkhunis, Buddhism won't last 50 years in the West. It's unsustainable. So we need you. We need bhikkhunis, nuns. And just the flack which you get for doing something which is important, which is right, you have to take that. Even if you get put in jail, you have to take that. Of course, there's nothing wrong which I did. There's nothing which is against the monastic rule, the title, or anything. So usually, if you're doing something right, please follow that heart and don't budge, don't move because of fear. Don't just take your own personal interest. That's not the point of why we're here living on this life. We're here to serve and move things along. If I move things along a little bit with the equity of Buddhism, it's really important. Because any sociologist knows that if you, if you empower women, men have already got enough power. If you empower women in society, you get a much more soft, many problems, social problems in the world just disappear. And I take this from the Muslim, ex-Muslim scholar, Ali Hirst Ali, who was a Muslim who moved to the Netherlands, renounced her Islam, became a member of parliament, you know, in Holland, and wrote a wonderful book about Islam from the inside. And she said, if you really want to solve the problem of violence and extremism in Islam, the very most effective way would be to empower Islamic women. In law, in education. And he said, in that way, you'll have an Islam without violence, without extremism. And many of the senior Islamic clerics know that so well, that they shot Malali, the young student who got the Nobel Prize this year for peace. She was advocating education for women in Pakistan. And they knew that if you empower women, the Taliban would be dead. There's Boko Haram in Nigeria, the Islamic group. Western education banned. What that means is education for women banned. So the empowering of women, so that all communities, is always a great positive step to the lack of, to the solution of domestic violence, child violence, intercommunal violence. It's one of the causes which any sociologist will tell you. And it's just not tenable right now for male priests in power to stop that. It's not tenable anymore. The world is just too dire a state, and there's no reason why it should not be the case. The Anglican Church now has bishops, female. Buddhism has female monks in Theravada. Vajrayana hasn't yet. It's about time that they got their act together and ordained. So that we have female monks without the tradition. Total equality. As it was in the time of the Buddha. One of the nice things about being a Buddhist is that equality was there from the very beginning, 2,500 years ago. In Christianity it wasn't. So we don't have to reinvent the scriptures. It's already there. So it's so easy for us to do. It's just the misogyny of Buddhist leaders because of lack of education, because of Confucian ideals of just following your teacher, because of the idea of harmony at all costs. And you know what happens, harmony at all costs in the Catholic Church, what that did. Don't tell anybody about the paedophilia. This is going to harm the Catholic Church. Harmony is more important. Sustaining of our religion is more important than anything else. You know what that did. These little kids, this example, this was recently in Australia, there's a Royal Commission, and in one Catholic institution in the Northern Territory, how can I say it, little kids were buggered so badly they had to wear nappies to school afterwards, they were bleeding like hell. That's disgusting. That's not tolerable. Why did that happen? Don't rock the boat. Keep harmony. The religion, the church, the priesthood is too important. That is unsustainable. You can't do that. That's evil. That's wrong. That's bad. So listen, if you know any Buddhist monk who acts like that, it's your job, your duty to preserve Buddhism, to let the police know. Otherwise you're destroying Buddhism. They'll get found out. You'll be in the same situation as the Buddhist, as the Catholic Church, Anglican, all these other people who abuse children, abuse anybody. Why hierarchies? Protecting the form at all costs, the harmony. I say it's important to lock the boat when your boat is going over Niagara Falls. Lock it, please, before it sinks. So that's an obvious thing. Unfortunately, there's many traditional Buddhists here who say, no, we cannot criticize the monks. We cannot criticize them. It's bad karma to criticize a holy monk. That is totally stupid. You can respect me enough to please, if there's any monk misbehaving, rock the boat quickly before the boat sinks. And one of the ways of stopping all of that nonsense is actually to have female clergy. In the Catholic Church, it would be great one day if we had a female pope. Actually, basically, we have no popes at all, excuse me, but no leaders. We have female priests. We have that now in Buddhism. I'm very proud of that. Which means that many people who were turning away from Theravada or Vajrayana or Mahayana because it wasn't fair, they talked about compassion for all beings. They didn't really mean it. They didn't practice it. They turned away from now, at least. The Buddhism which I love, which has given me so much happiness and peace, the problems are solving. You're welcome in my monastery. You're welcome to ordain. And I will support you to the max. Thank you. Any questions? Comments? Let's make it more of a... Do you want to ask something? Just, yeah, continue.
No, if you're happy to field your own questions,
I'm happy. Oh, yes, sure. Yes, go on.
Surely, I
have
many more rules for
the monks. Yes, there are 318 rules for the monks, only 227 for the monks. That's really unfair, because a monk I need more rules. Because in Buddhism, the more rules you get, the higher you are. You have 5 preceptors, and in a monastery they sit in the back. 8 preceptors are in front of them, 10 precepts for the novice, 27 for the monk. So in that sense, the nun should be higher than the monks. They've got more precepts. The precepts were just put there, you know, just ad hoc as things arose. But one of my favourite precepts for the nun, because it's a bit too serious, and you know, it's, you know, a monk has a sense of humour. This is the 8th Pratyekya rule for the bhikkhus. Because one day, one of the nuns in the monastery, her job was to clean out the toilets. Now remember, they didn't have any plumbing, septic tanks or sewage systems, so this went into a few buckets, and she had to take those buckets and put them in the right place in the corner of the monastery. But she was so lazy that early in the morning, instead of putting it in the proper place, she threw the bucket over the monastery wall. And as it happened, that day, there was a man, a businessman, who was well dressed on his way to the palace to see the king. And as he was walking past the nun's monastery thinking about business, a bucket of shit fell on his head. And he was very upset. He knew where it came from, and so he said, "These bloody nuns, they're not real nuns, look what they've done to me, I'm not going to stand for this." Now in those days they didn't have electric lights, they had little torches which were attached to poles, like flame torches, to see the way. So he took one of those flame torches and went into the nun's monastery to actually burn it up. And there was a man who was a gatekeeper just coming out of the monastery and asked him, he saw this man with his bucket of shit all dripping down his head. He said, "What happened to you?" He said, "Oh, they did to me. These bloody nuns, they bucked the shit on my head. I was just about to go to the palace, and then I'm going to burn the whole monastery down. That's what I'm going to do. And this layman, this gatekeeper said, you've got a bucket of shit on your head. That's auspicious. That's lucky. These are holy nuns. That's better than holy water. That's really personal. You are so lucky. Now, in my life as a monk, it's amazing what you make people will believe. A bit of string around your wrist, a bit of holy water, a bit of chanting, you can do anything. So, this layman bought it. I said, really? It's lucky? He said, yes. Now look, don't go down the monastery. You haven't got time. You do that later if you want to. Go home, have a wash, get changed, go back to the palace. I'm sure that you're going to have good luck today. You should be blessed by holy nuns. So he took that, got dressed, showered, got dressed, went to the palace, and as luck would have it, the king gave him a very lucrative contract for his business. It worked. And he went around telling all his business friends, if you want good luck in business, you go to the nuns' monastery and get blessed. Now, not with water, but with the real stuff. And when the Buddha heard it, nuns, come over here. You were really lucky that time that this stupid businessman bought that rubbish. So don't do that again. And so the eighth particular rule for nuns is you shall not throw a bucket of shit over the monastery wall. It's there, you can read it for yourself. Well, I've read that, just love this rule I've ever seen. So all nuns have to practice that now. Let's go on.
You mentioned at one point that the priests in Sri Lanka were sort of an offshoot of colonization by the British people. And I'm wondering, because you also mentioned this notion of not rocking the boat,
yeah.
And I'm thinking we've lost a lot around the world in terms of trying to keep things civil all the time.
Yeah.
Do you feel that this also came from colonization?
Okay, you're asking that. I think what I said about Sri Lanka is the hierarchization, the making hierarchies in Sri Lanka came from the Buddhists, from the colonial masters, the British. And and that gave me control. And sometimes when there's something wrong, is it good to rock the boat? Because in other places in the world, such as Hong Kong, is rocking the boat the right thing to do? And are you going to make any sort of advances, headway there? And I think you will see that the response to the Hong Kong protesters are much less than what happened in Tiananmen Square. Those people lost their lives in Tiananmen Square and the riots in those days. They made it easier to protest. They never achieved their ends at that time. I'm not sure whether the protesters in Hong Kong are going to achieve their ends, but could bring it closer because of their sacrifices. So sometimes you've got to choose the time you rock the boat. But certainly you should never think that harmony at all costs. Sometimes you need to stir things up, to be the whistleblower, to stand up and say this is wrong, to be the person who sees that the emperor's wearing no clothes, because everyone is too scared or too proud to say that. And so you have to rock the boat sometimes. The one nice thing about Buddhism originally, we're always allowed to do that. And if the boat was strong enough, it would take all the rocking. Only weak boats sort of sink in the storms. Strong ones survive. So it is a way of testing out what Buddhism, what government, what policies really are good. Rock it and see what happens. I was used to life when I was young, rock and roll.
Yeah.
Is there a limit to rocking the boat? I mean, do you use violence, for example? Some people, I've heard so many people taking up the excuse of rocking the boat to challenge the authorities that say, we have to go and say great things
You know, I can say this university is an Islamic center, it's not a Buddhist center.
When?
The Muslims are far more violent. They've got an Islamic center here in Shia.
Yeah, well, I'm not really talking about
But people say that you Buddhists should grow a few things and then you get more recognition. I say, no, why we can't do that? But you know, there is something which that statement actually says. Sometimes, in the West, especially Buddhists, are far too passive. How many Buddhist members of parliament do you have in Canada? How many Islamic members of parliament do you have? You have some, don't you? How come there's no Buddhist members of parliament? Buddhists are far too passive. And don't go to be violent, because Lord violence is usually counterproductive. But certainly, just being a bit more assertive is a wonderful thing to do. Yes? So?
When did you think Ajahn Chah was an educated man? And also, what his
teachings were? Yes, Ajahn Chah was an exceptional case. He too only had 4 years in school. But sometimes there are some people who are just naturally intelligent, very innovative. And that was what attracted many people to him. You know what he said, I don't know where he got it from, but when you look back at what he said and compare it to what Buddha said, it matched. And it was inspiring, some of the ways he taught and just how brilliant they were. One of the ones I've been saying when I was teaching meditation, he said if you really want to get anywhere in meditation or in getting some insights, he said you should remember the simile of the mango orchard. The mango orchard planted by the Buddha. If you throw sticks up at the tree, the mango never falls. If you shake the tree, it never falls. If you climb up the tree, it never falls. If you want the mangoes from the trees planted by the Buddha, you have to sit perfectly still under that mango tree and open up your hand and mangoes will fall by themselves. And that was an Ajahn Chah simile, which was absolutely brilliant. Many people meditate and they try to calm their mind down. They really try hard to attain things. And they never get anything except frustration. And the same way in Buddhism, to attain deep meditation experiences, enlightenment, you have to learn to sit perfectly still. And just open up the heart. And all these incredible things that just fall into you. You go chasing them, trying to make them happen, and they never fall. That was an Ajahn Chah. At the same time, he was just so funny. There was this story of this one monk I was with. His name was Gary from New Mexico. I was in a car in the back with him. There was another Westerner who spoke perfect Thai. And also in the back of Ajahn Chah, the passenger seat, the driver going to the railway station. Without any warning, Ajahn Chah turned around, looked at this American novice, Gary, and said, "You are thinking about your girlfriend back in New Mexico." And he read his mind. It's okay to read your mind when you're thinking about nice things, but when you're thinking about your old girlfriends, that really, really sucks. Ajahn Chah catching you out. So there's this poor monk, and his jaw dropped. The Ajahn Chah said to you, "Don't worry, we can help you. Next time you write to your girlfriend, ask her to send something personal to her to remind yourself of her. Because sometimes you have a picture or something of your girlfriend, you don't feel so lonely, it's just so heartbroken." He said, "Can I do that? Is that allowable?" I said, "Oh yes, it's allowable." Those who read my book know what's coming next. He said, "Send her a bottle and ask her to send something most personal. Ask her to send some of her shit. So whenever you miss her, you can open up the bottle. Oh, this is my girlfriend's excrement.
She won't feel so lonely. Okay, Joe, gross.
No, it's so funny. And it's a bit of a teasing because, you know, when you're falling in love, I love anything about you, my darling. Well, not quite anything. So you ask, if you're in the nuns as well, if you miss your boyfriend, ask her to send you a bottle of her shit. And when you really miss her, open it up, don't wish her anymore. Totally unromantic. Yeah, go on. Sometimes they don't listen to women, quite frankly. So that's my job. They listen to me, I'm very well known in Sri Lanka, go on TV, and they think that I'm really something. So it's up to me to tell the Sri Lankan men, women, and their women, you need to support these women. So if you get a few influential monks, now, I was saying earlier that sometimes, I don't believe in hierarchies, but I use them for my own ends sometimes. I am very senior. I am well known, so I've got the power now, not just to build one, she's to ordain them, but to change the mindsets of traditional monks. To show them and deny it. But interestingly, I wrote a very simple article. Know about gender equality in Buddhism, including the reasons why the bikini ordination is valid. And I was to present this in Vietnam at the United Nations Day of BASAC celebrations last May. It was sponsored by the UN, where the theme of the conference was the 8 Millennium Development Goals. Now in 2000, the United Nations decided that every country should sign up to the development goals, number 3 of which was gender equity. And the UN wanted to find out what Buddhism was doing. And this was a meeting of Buddhist leaders from many countries. And so I submitted a paper, Gender Equity in Theravada Buddhism. And it was accepted by the academic panel as a good paper. And I travelled all the way to Hanoi, and when I arrived, the next day, the first day of the conference, I was told by the organisers it was bad. Because they didn't want to talk about bikinis. And I thanked them for banning that paper, because when I got known and people heard about it, a huge petition came about. I was given the copy of the petition in London about a week ago, over 5,000 signatures. And so, if I'd have read that out in a conference, only maybe about 30 people would have listened to it. By banning it, it became a very well-read article throughout the world. So thank you, you misogynists. in Hawaii, for Bhagavan Mahaprabhu, who did a great service for the Buddhists. So that's not what we can do. Go on.
From your talk, I understand that when you look at Buddhist scriptures, you decide that some of the words cannot have come from the Buddha because they are misogynistic, or they clearly don't express what the Buddha had said about the quality of men and women to attain enlightenment, and in the order of the Dharma, you find these Garudas, or you find Buddhas that clearly nuns, vikunis and bhikkhus are not equal. And you are saying now, if we look at, we have to take the essence, which is equality, and we have to follow that. So if you go with that line, wouldn't you now have to go further? For example, with the rule that when a bhikkhuni becomes ordained, there have to be bhikkhunis and bhikkhus, but when a bhikkhu becomes ordained, only bhikkhus. Why not bhikkhunis? Wouldn't you have now to have the same rules if you really want equality between the two?
Yes, you're asking that, if you ask me to repeat the question as much as I could, I mentioned that we have to find out what the original rules were of the Buddha, and as we can find those original rules, then we can come much closer to equality, because that equality was there in the beginning. Two of the monks in my monastery, Ajahn Brahmanya and Sujata, have just completed something they call the Authenticity Project, which they have taken a scholastic, Western-based argument to try and find out what were those original teachings, using archaeological evidence, using comparison with similar texts in other traditions, and being helped by other scholars like Bhikkhu Bodhi and Anarya in Hamburg, and Richard Gombrich as well in Oxford. If the thing is available online now or will be very soon, a very strong argument, using convergence from many, many different angles, to have a very good idea, of what is original Buddhism. But one argument they cannot use is what we would love original Buddhism to be. That they have to put aside all of what they would like to see and actually see what's really there. So at least we can actually see what's really there. The rule of having two sides is there. But there's also a very strong argument. This is legal stuff. At first, the Buddha had ordination actually just by bhikkhus. And that was never revealed. It was still there. So you can still have one side. And then finally, he also says the rules for the monks should be the same as the rules for the nuns. So there is an argument there, you can actually get to there. But some of the monks are just going step by step. Let's get at least the equity to allow ordination first of all. Let's get the equity and mutual respect rather than the subservience of the eight Garudas. Let's get that first of all, but let's not stop.
I have another
question.
When you describe the way how monasteries should function according to the Buddha, which sounded to me like a very local functioning. You said that your community in Australia had no duty to report to anybody about upcoming ordination. Then I wonder, for example, when one looks at the Thai forest tradition website, it looks like an international community. When I visited Tisarana, then Ajahn Biralam told me if I want to change any of the rules that we had agreed upon, then I would have to talk to the larger community. I cannot just change at least important things. I cannot just change on my own. So that seems to be a contradiction. So, don't you feel any commitment to a larger community? And in relation to that, I had also heard that the one of the reasons, or maybe the main reasons, why the Sangha in Thailand reacted so negatively to the ordination was that they have organized a meeting where they wanted to address this subject, and just shortly before, and without having announced that you did your ordination, which was like a form to them, what would you say to that?
Do you all hear that, or should I repeat it? You could hear it?
No.
Okay. That's a long question.
Yes,
now, first of all, I was saying that as a monastic community, you have autonomy, so you, I said my monastery did not have to answer or ask any other monastery. That is original Buddhism. The idea of associations of monasteries came much, much later. It's not original. And so the only thing which you are bound to is the monastic rules you have to get and hold together. Now that is basically non-negotiable. I can't change the Vinaya. No one can do that. There's some of these other rules which, you know, you can have, you know, interpretations. Now, can you have cheese in the afternoon, soy milk in the afternoon? That is this in the grey area, so everyone's you can choose for themselves. And sometimes groups of monasteries decide to choose. But that isn't obligatory. You can choose to do that or choose not to. And the other thing is what I mentioned, that when you do some push-up steps, people actually take all sorts of angles to try and sort of to destroy the person rather than look at the ordination of the agreements. Focus on the person who did this Ajahn Brahm and actually ordination for females. And what they were saying there, that it was about to be discussed in a meeting. No one, I organized that meeting, it was supposed to be in Perth. No one suggested discussing the bikinis. I did. I put it on the agenda. No one was interested. And I knew from the president of the Layers Association, a fellow called George Sharp, in Amorati in England, that the leader at that time, Senator, was really against bikini ordination. Incredibly against it. And at the same time, even though they said there was a meeting about bikini ordination, one day after I informed Senator that I was going to ordain, they released the 5 points banning bikini ordination in Amawati Chittas. They'd already considered that. They'd already spent weeks, only about 3 or 4 of them, actually working out these 5 points. And it's hypocrisy to say that I didn't ask them and we went ahead with ordaining bikunis. And in fact, at the same time, even before bikuni ordination, they went ahead banning bikuni ordination, formally, legally, in their community. Hypocrisy. And then they consulted even their local community. And some of the nuns, like Ayurveda Nandi, Sati Sona, was really pissed off that a couple of monks were discussing issues without consulting the nuns who would affect, you know, in England. So at that time, many of the nuns left. Some of the lay supporters, because they didn't want to be part of the organization anymore.
But doesn't that also have a historical precedent? Because when after the Buddha's demise, when the monks met and decided about Vinaya, we don't hear that any of the nuns, even though we announced that one of the nuns was an expert in Vinaya, she wasn't invited to talk according to the scriptures.
Indeed, it wasn't invited to talk, which was unacceptable at that time. The Buddha passed away. Maybe if the Buddha was around, he would have had them come. But I don't know, I can't say about that. But certainly, the idea of consultation is that anything which is done, you have to actually have the local community. It's called Samukha Vinaya. You have to have everyone present. So in my modesty, I can't make any rule, I can't discuss anything if the person is not there. So if you are going to make a rule for the nuns in any community, the nuns have to be there, they have to be part of discussion. And they're happening anything. So a bit of a sort of hypocrisy there. This is just general. Whenever you do something which stirs up people, always looking at weak points, trying to sort of challenge you, never look at what they're doing to us. But anyway, this is a bit of academic because they want to research this project. This is the whole thing. So that's why I said, look, you don't have to inform. I actually informed out of courtesy without any pressure. I just went and told Venerable Sumedho that I was going to do this. And it was only about a couple of weeks after we made the final decision. It wasn't being planned for 12 years, as somebody said. So this is actually what happens sometimes when you do make a change. And you have accusations which go around, which you aren't allowed to defend. And they're just put out there, and just it's very hard to say that, you know, what actually happened. You can see the whole picture. That's always the case whenever you whistleblow. You know, whistleblower protection in Canada? There's somebody in the company sees someone doing something wrong.
Yes.
And then you tell the police. And what do the company do? They sack them, they say they're a bad person, they get bullied. So we have whistleblower protection now. And it's really, really a tough thing to be a whistleblower. You have to have a very tough skin because you are going to get a lot of personal criticism. So that's very similar to what happened to me. But you know, I'm talking about it for a long time.
So if you're a Buddha,
okay,
how do you reconcile that within your thoughts?
Within your thoughts?
Do you dismiss it?
Oh, you dismiss it, you let it go. Because there's one story I always focus on. You know, there's these stories I write about in my books and I teach every other week on YouTube, two bad bricks in a wall. The two bad bricks in a wall story, if you don't know it, when I first went to Australia, I had to build walls myself, but I was a medical physicist, never done anything with my hands before. So I built a wall, and after I finished, two bricks were cooking. I never knew how to hand, because I was careful. And as soon as I saw the two back bricks, I tried to scrape out the mortar to reset them. And it's hard, I couldn't do it. I was with another monk, and I asked that monk, can I have some, can we buy some dynamite, blow up the wall so I can start again. Push it over the bulldozer. I really wanted to destroy that wall. And we couldn't afford that. And so I had to live with my two back bricks which spoiled the whole wall for 3 months. No, literally, I had nightmares about that. You woke up in a sweat. You stupid mind. Because anyone could see it. It was true that I volunteered to take visitors around. I'll take them another route. The way they would never see my wall. I was so embarrassed. And it happened one day that I was with a visitor and they saw that wall and they said it was a beautiful wall. I couldn't believe what they said. I said, can you see the two bad routes? And they said, yes, but I can also see 998 good bricks as well. And once I, that was actually, that really changed a lot of my life. Why do you always focus on the two bad bricks? Why do our eyes always go there? Oh God, that's a mistake. Why in a relationship, in a marriage, boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, we always see the two bad things in the husband. And that causes divorce. You want to blow up the whole relationship. But a blow up the friendship of monks you've known for such a long time because they did a few mistakes. So how I would react to that is that some of these monks, like actually we are running for 40 years, he's a friend, I don't care what he's done or said, he's always going to be a friend. So those are two bad bricks. He's got thousands of good bricks. And so I just let that one go. And that's important if people treat you badly. If they abuse you, then don't just look at the abuse, look at the other things in them. And then you can still be their friend and still love them and care for them. That's what Buddhism is, I learned. And I actually practiced. called forgiveness.
So I don't know why they did that.
So okay, that encourages. You can do that, but we can still be friends.
Go on then.
Great question.
I went to a conference once when somebody asked that question of a Sri Lankan monk. He was a head monk at Queens Monastery in New York. And he said, absolutely no way. The audience in Singapore, they just lambasted him. I've never seen them so angry. What are you saying? There cannot be a female Buddha. And so then they asked me the question, I said, look, the reason why a Buddha becomes, say, a man 2,500 years ago, was just because in that culture, at that time, a man's body was the most useful way of teaching. He may have not gotten as much traction in that culture if he was a female. The situation has changed totally in 2,500 years. So if there's a Buddha in Canada, they may very well choose a female form because they would be given just as much respect and their teachings would have no impediments just because of their gender. They'd be respected and heard. But 2,500 years ago, chose to be a man because that was the best way of teaching. So the answer is yes, they can. That's it. I'll just get into it. Can we have a more controversial question? It's not my usual talk you see on YouTube, but no, there was an academic and I wanted to get some information about a peculiar nation. Look, it is historic. You tell people that in Theravada Buddhism, this is going to go down in the history books. Now, we started something, we revived it. You know, after such a long time, just like somebody having an extinct animal, they find a new one, and they breed it, and it's breeding, and it's growing. That is exciting. It's really strong, powerful Buddhist news. So you're part of it. Well done. We live in an age where we have to get this in front.
Speaking pretty much all day today.
Yeah, I'm used to it.
Thank you so much for your wonderful lecture. It was wonderful to welcome you here. Really a privilege to have you. And if you can spare a few more minutes, if people look at your books and would like them to be signed, but we also don't want to exhaust you.
No, it's okay. It's only 6 o'clock. The night is still young. So if anyone's got anything to say, please.